Paul writes 1 Timothy to tell Timothy, counter false teaching in Ephesus. That's why I'm telling you to stay there, counter it. And when he gets around to saying what he should do first, beginning of chapter 2, first of all, then, I urge you to pray. So people ask me all the time, what are you going to do about all of this false teaching? But very few people turn up to the prayer meetings to pray about it. So that should be our first of all response to any of this.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast for FIEC leaders and other leaders too. And another leader is with me. My name is Adrian Reynolds, Head of National Ministries for the FIEC. And I'm joined today by Lee Gaitis. Hello, Lee. Nice to see you.
And also with you.
Yes, and also with you. We are going to be talking about the Anglican Church. So thank you for just rooting that in an appropriate liturgical introduction. Lee, we'd love to know what you do, but I think I need to ask you where you are, because it looks like you are an Anglican on steroids with pictures of the great and good Anglican. Is that your bedroom wall? Is that how you, you've kept your marriage fire alight all these years? Or where are you?
That's right. Well, I mean, obviously, I do have portraits of David Peterson and Mike Obie up in my house as well. But I'm actually away from home at the moment. I'm here at Oak Hill Theological College in London. And that's why we have these marvelous portraits of the great and the good as the backdrop. I'm doing on a bit of study leave just for a few days to do some work on a commentary series that I'm
editing. Okay, well, tell us about that. This is a new commentary series, isn't it?
It is.
Does the world need another commentary series? What's special about this one, other than it's edited by Lee Gaitis? What else is important about this one?
That obviously would be distinctive enough to get people
well,
to
indeed.
Buy it. Well, I mean, when I was ordained as an Anglican, I was told to proclaim afresh in this generation the unchanging gospel. And so that's what every commentary series does too. So if you look at something like the Bible Speaks Today commentaries from the last generation or two.
Yeah, much loved.
Much loved and greatly used. I mean, John Stott's commentary on 2 Timothy was very influential on persuading me to be an ordained minister, for example. They're a little bit old now. They're a little bit, as I pithily put it, they're male, pale, and stale, okay, to a certain extent.
I'm glad I didn't write one.
I mean, they're still usable, but they are getting a bit old, yeah. And don't interact with 21st century concerns or with more recent scholarship. So there's always
worldwide concerns to a certain extent.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And so that's what we've done, really, building on the back of the NIV Proclamation Bible, which I edited a few years ago. We had 65 scholars involved in that with, they were from about 4 continents all over the world. And Hodder said to me, what can we do on the back of this? What's the next project? And I foolishly suggested one thing they might consider would be to produce a new 50-volume Bible commentary series, trying to replace the Bible Speaks Today sort of series. Great for preachers,
but also for
Bible study group leaders as well. So get the best scholars and pastors and writers involved from all over the world and get them writing for the church, really, not for the academy. Okay.
So when should we look out for those volumes dropping? Soon? Or do we have to hold our breath?
That depends on how well I do during my time at Oak Hill this week.
Okay.
But the first volumes are scheduled to come out next year, 2024, in the summer. We hope to have 5, maybe 10 volumes next year out of the 50. So the ones I've been editing so far are terrific. There's an excellent commentary on Luke's Gospel by the man behind me, by David Peterson there, which is going to be terrific, but also great commentary by Eric Ortland here at Oak Hill on Ecclesiastes. And I don't mind telling you, I had a tear or two in my eyes as I was reading the last couple of pages of that one. It's very moving as well as sound and
helpful. Well, you've whetted our appetite, Lee. Thanks very much. But we're not here to talk about commentaries. We're here to talk about the Church of England, the Anglican Church.
And
we have to. And let me just explain why I think we have to. So the podcast is mainly for FIEC leaders, leaders of independent churches, not exclusively people who listen to it. but we're concerned for the gospel wherever it's preached and proclaimed. And I think one of the remarkable things really that's happened in the last 20 years in Britain amongst evangelicals is we've become a lot less parochial. We understand the importance of gospel partnership. Many of us are in gospel partnerships. Many of us will be mates with people serving in Anglican churches in all kinds of contexts. We'll have perhaps trained with them. We might have attended something with them over the years. And we long to see the gospel flourish. And we're a little perplexed. We don't quite understand what's going on, Lee. We want to be able to pray well. We also want to be able to support brothers and sisters who are serving in Anglican church as well. We're nervous about making missteps. We want to act in a way that's godly and helpful. We don't want to be unhelpful. And so, Lee, we're really helping and hoping and thankful that you're here today to really walk us through so we can understand some of what's going on and we can know how we can support some of our Anglican brothers and sisters. We see the great importance of standing firm for the truth, and we want to know how to help brothers and sisters do that as we know they do for us.
So yeah, well, that fellowship and the partnerships that we have between Anglicans and FIC and Presbyterians and others who are on the same page when it comes to the gospel and the need for mission, those partnerships are deeply important and precious to us. So I hope we will be able to guard those and encourage one another in difficult times.
Thank you. Now, can we start by understanding what's going on? So here we are at the end of June, which means July is almost upon us. And it would be good if you could just reflect briefly for us, Lee, on what happened earlier in the year. But also, we were kind of expecting July to be the big, kickoff moment, but I think the only thing that's been kicked is the can, it seems. But maybe we just need to understand that a little better. So can you just give us a kind of a brief overview of where we're up to with the Living in Love and Faith process and what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, so the Church of England has been embroiled in this Living in Love and Faith process for several years now. There's been a book and all sorts of material and discussions about homosexuality, sexuality in general, marriage, identity, and so on. In the February General
Which, Synod. Sorry, it's worth saying, alive issues wherever you're serving. I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of church you're serving in. If you're a pastor in a church, these are live issues, aren't you, for wherever you are.
Yes, that's right. Particularly issues of transgender identity and so on at the moment are very hot button issues all over the world. So the Church of England, I mean, we've been talking about this for 40 years in the Church of England, at least.
Only that long.
But in depth for at least 10 years, maybe longer. And this latest thing is LLF, Living in Love and Faith. At the February Synod, General Synod meeting, the bishops just suddenly presented us with prayers of love and faith. So there was no warrant that I could see within the LLF material to justify a change in our doctrine. It just wasn't doing that. It wasn't arguing for something. So the next thing you expected was, well, if the bishops want to do something, they ought to make a case for it and tell us why. There was none of that. There was nothing, no theological paper, no biblical justification, no even pragmatic justification. Just suddenly dropped on us were some prayers of love and faith, which were designed not to have gay weddings in church. It's not that. The idea is to have prayers of blessing and dedication for those who are in partnerships, in same-sex relationships of various kinds. And it is sometimes quite vague. And it makes you wonder what kind of partnerships they've got in mind. But it's clear.
So this is more than just turning a blind eye to something. This is actively praying for blessing upon
them. And what the interesting thing is a lot of the prayers that were suggested by the bishops have been taken directly from the marriage service. It's very clear what's going on. Some of it's brand new, but some of it's just taken out of the marriage service. So that's what it's about. Now, these were supposed to be just put forward as an optional provision for those who want to use
them. So you're not obliged to use these with a couple?
Not obliged, not mandatory. At least that's what they say. Of course, we all know where these things go. And there's a well-known law in the church that when you make orthodoxy optional, then very soon it will be banned. And we've seen that on other issues in the past. So it is just this power play from the bishops, and at the same time, a sort of Jedi mind trick. So they've said to us,
these are not the prayers you think they are.
Yes, this is not a change of doctrine.
Okay.
This is not the change of doctrine you think it is. So Anglican doctrine has long been sex outside of marriage is a sin and should be called.
Yeah, yeah. So that's Lambeth 110 that we often
hear
about.
Back to 1987, General Synod Motion, the Lambeth 1998 resolutions. That's what we've always said. But suddenly we're to believe that we're not changing that, but we are going to bless relationships outside of that. And the bishops just say, this is not a change of doctrine, when everyone can see it clearly is. So obviously there was quite a lot of pushback against that in the General Synod, though it did narrowly scrape through, but only on the basis that the bishops would definitely make sure that whatever they brought back to the Synod for final approval in July or whenever would definitely not be a departure from Anglican doctrine. So they've got to somehow square this circle.
So it wasn't really a vote of approval. It was a vote of, it wasn't saying no, but it wasn't saying yes either, really.
It was sort of take this forward, but make sure it's not, definitely not a departure from our doctrine or indicative of a departure from our doctrine. At the same time, just after that, there was a large meeting of Anglicans from all over the world in what's called GAFCON, the Global Anglican Futures Conference. It's a bad name. Is it a gaff? Is it a con? Who knows?
It sounds like it's both at the same time.
Yeah, it's a gathering of those who don't want the church worldwide to be liberal, basically. They want to push back on the changes in the last 20 years in this sort of direction. So it's not all evangelical. Some of it's quite high church, but it's people who don't like this more liberal agenda. And that was very encouraging. I was there. It was an encouraging time in Rwanda. I had to pay for my ticket. I wasn't sent by the Home Secretary.
Well, you missed a trick there.
Yeah. So it was very encouraging because they said they held the line on those issues and said that they would support, encourage and pray for those of us within the Church of England who were trying to push back against this. They've also set up the Anglican Mission in England and other things to basically provide a lifeboat outside the Church of England for those who want to have international backing without being in the Church of England. And that's great. But they also said they support us in it and staying in it. Because it showed us that we're not the weirdos.
Yes.
You know, Church Society are not the weirdos here. We are on the same page as Anglicans around the world.
And not just Anglicans, Christians. The overwhelming majority, and not just a majority, super majority, whatever the technical term is, of Christians around the world take an Orthodox view of marriage, as do the overwhelming super majority of Anglicans. That's right, isn't it?
They do. 85% of Anglicans in church on Sunday were represented at that GAFCON conference.
Okay.
And we overwhelmingly passed that resolution. So there was that. Then also the Church of England Evangelical Council has also been meeting and talking and discussing. Now, that's a group which is broader than Church Society. Church Society is really the sort of conservative, reforms, complementarian mostly. Evangelicals within the Church.
You're like the FIC of the Anglican world.
That's it. Well, I feel proud to bear that kind of thing. Yes, thank you.
Do you have any authority, Lee, personally?
I have authority over my staff, I suppose.
Okay, you are the FIC of the Anglican world, and that's how I like to describe it. Okay,
that's it, yes. Are you going to persuade me that we should be Congregationalists next? Don't do that.
That's it now for my persuasion.
But the CEEC is a group that's a bit broader than us, and it includes charismatics, such as New Wine, people in New Wine, and it includes those who are egalitarian on the issues of women's ordination, as well as complementarian.
So HTB part of that? That's a lot more huge network, isn't it?
It's sort of a fringe part of the CEEC network in various ways, yeah. So we've been meeting, and obviously all on the same sort of page, wanting to push back against these things. and coordinate our efforts on that. So we're working together to, in co-belligerent sort of way, and organizing in Synod and outside against these developments.
Just before we move on from that Synod, can I just ask you a technical question?
Yeah.
And then I've got a slightly harder question, just about the status as it was. Where does authority lie in the Anglican Church? Is it with bishops? Is it with the Church of England? Is it bishops? Is it the Archbishop? Is it the Synod? Who has the ultimate say? How does that work, very briefly?
Well, the head of the Church of England is the Lord Jesus Christ.
Thank you.
And so our doctrine officially and legally is defined by the scriptures.
Right.
And the teachings of the scriptures, the teachings of the early church fathers that are in accordance with the scriptures, things like the creeds. And you particularly find our doctrine in the 39 articles, the Book of Common Prayer and the ordinal, the homilies, things like that, officially. And then to enforce that, we have bishops in every diocese. Now, every diocese is different. There's 40 or so dioceses around the country, and one in Europe. There's the Diocese of Europe. And there are synods at every level too, to involve the clergy and the laity alongside the bishops. So there's quite a lot of balancing of powers and authorities and ability to do things throughout the system,
right?
From the local to the diocesan to the national, and laity and clergy are involved at every level alongside the bishops. So it's really a diffused power. Okay.
So you have to be fighting at all those different levels, really, for the truth.
Well, that's contending right. So what comes to the appointments in a church, for example, who's going to be the next vicar, the power there is shared between the congregation, the bishop, and the patron. In a church society, we're patrons in 130 parishes, so we have a say and are supposed to basically support the parish against the bishop often to find the next vicar. So that is an example, a snapshot of where the power lies.
Okay, Lee, can I ask you a difficult question, which I don't mean to be offensive. I really don't mean to be offensive, but I don't want to ask my mate around the corner this question because it's not the right moment. But I do want to understand the answer. I read an extraordinary article by Richard Coles, ex of the Communards, now ex-vicar, from just around the corner here, actually, in the Times a few weeks ago, basically saying he's been doing this all along. He's been marrying people. So, forgive the bluntness. Aren't the prayers just essentially representing what's already happening? How would you respond to that?
In one way, yes. We all know that there have been people nibbling away at orthodoxy in that way, but in other ways as well.
And that's true for all kinds of church groupings, isn't it?
Yes. And in other ways, no, it's not just the same old, same old. So, I mean, many years ago, we had a bishop of Durham who went around saying that the resurrection was a conjuring trick with bones.
Yes,
but that wasn't the official position of the Church of England. Mm. We've had bishops who say there is no God, honest to God, John Robinson, and so on. But that's not been the official position of the Church of England.
Okay, that's helpful. So that's the sea change. It's changing the official position. And actually, whether Richard Coles got away with it or not, that's a question of discipline. That's not a question of doctrine.
Yes.
That's the wrong category for it. Right.
I don't think his bishop necessarily knew that he was doing
that. He might have been disciplined for it.
That is one of the problems, actually. We've had a breakdown in discipline. The General Synod decided many years ago, when it was refreshing the clergy discipline measure, that it would explicitly exclude doctrine and ritual from the discipline measure. So you can be disciplined for sleeping with your secretary or whatever, but you can't be disciplined for any matters of doctrine or ritual under the new measure. So you have to go back to archaic laws that nobody's ever used, and it just makes it very difficult as a free-for-all, basically. I could preach almost anything I wanted in a Church of England church and get away with it.
But you can't run down the street naked.
No, I'd probably be disciplined for that.
Lee, let's press on because we'll run out of time. We expected looking in for this all to be resolved in July. That's what they said. That's not going to happen, right?
No, it's not. So they split into three different groups to look at the prayers, to look at pastoral guidance that needs to replace the current guidance on the behavior of the clergy. And that's going to look at things like, is it all right for us to have sex outside of marriage? And what do you do if someone's in a gay marriage? Currently, that's not allowed. All those things are not allowed, and have held, you know, you're not allowed to get married to your boyfriend. That you will fail to get a license you do that. But they're thinking about revising that. And then there's a group looking at pastoral reassurance, which is a very patronizing way of saying, what do we do with all those people who want to stick to the Bible and Orthodox Christianity? In July, they're going to double down and say, we're keeping on with this stuff. But then in November, those three groups will come back, report, and we'll have a vote. So the ding-dong argument is probably going to happen in November. That's when it will happen.
Yeah, but good to be praying now, because the work is being done now.
Right. The work is being done now, and there are good conservative evangelical people involved in that. Charlie Screen, for example, from All Souls Lang Place, is involved in one of those groups, alongside all sorts of people who would take Richard Coles's sort of view. And then we'll have fallout in 2024. I imagine Justin Welby is probably going to retire at some point after that. And then there'll be a free-for-all. But what's happening now is the problem. In the Church of England now, all your vicar friends in your gospel partnerships are struggling with this. They're either bored to death by it, or exhausted by it, or nauseated by what's going on. And they're struggling with this big intake of breath before July and November hit them, not knowing what's going on.
And presumably that works at different levels, because there'll be a concern and a worry and anxiety about what's happening in the church in general. But actually, they're all pastors of local churches. Yeah. And so, you know, I've got ministry mates who are close to me who are in revitalization situations, we would call them. They've got into essentially a non-evangelical or a struggling parish. And they'll be in a very different context from, well, another church that you know well, just down the road south of Kettering, where there's been solid evangelical teaching for decades.
Exactly.
So actually, we need to have some sensitivity, don't we, to the context?
Yeah, that's right. So in church society, we actually have now a network of revitalization ministries, NORM, we call it, NORM, the Network of Revitalization Ministries, where we try to gather and help the people who are in exactly that situation. Mm-hmm. They've gone into a middle of the road or struggling Anglican church, and they're trying to turn it around over a period of years with patient evangelical preaching, teaching, pastoring ministry. And that's going to be very different, where you don't know if the PCC, the church council, and the congregation are going to be on board if you suddenly bring up all of this stuff. Whereas many other churches will have been doing this for years, and but even then, evangelical churches don't have a sort of uniformity always. There are always going to be people struggling either themselves or theoretically with these issues, because the church is being catechized by the world, by TV, by newspapers, and by people they work alongside.
And I guess every Anglican church, and in this sense, be different from FIEC churches, every Anglican church would have people who come along because it is the local parish church.
Yeah.
Who perhaps don't have a grounding. You know, they move to a new area. They come along because that's what they do. So pretty much every Anglican church will have folk like that, won't it?
Absolutely. Yes. We all have a big fringe of people. I mean, bigger in some places than others. Who just come because it is their local parish church, and because that actually has been over centuries the best way for the gospel to reach that place.
Yeah.
You know, there's one big church in the center of the village with a village green and a thatched cottage and a vicarage. That's been an obvious place to start gospel ministry and an obvious place to gather anybody for funerals, baptisms, weddings, whatever.
Yeah.
And so it is a struggle wherever you are, knowing how to deal with the pastoral issues, the theological issues. I think there are a lot of churches that are well-known evangelical churches in the Church of England, but haven't actually taught on this issue and would say, well, we don't know where the PCC, the Church Council, are on this issue. And this has been a real spur to many of them to say, well, perhaps we ought to be addressing some of these things and talking about them.
Yeah. Lee, how can I help my mate down the road? I'm thinking especially of, there are some people that I'll know very well, right?
Yeah.
That, maybe I went to college with them. We've stayed in a little fraternal group. We're best of mates. I don't have a problem ringing him up. Let's call him Bob. I can ring Bob up, have a very honest conversation. We're really good friends. But Trev, who's just down the road the other way, I know him. I know him from gospel partnership stuff, perhaps. But we don't hang out together. But he's a good ministry mate. How can I be a help to him? I'm worried about misstepping. I'm worried about being patronizing. He's been a great help to me in the past. How can I help him now? Okay, what advice have you got for me to be able to, reach out in a way that's helpful and sensitive? I don't just want to ignore him. He may want me to ignore him, but I don't just want to pretend, you're over there, this is your issue.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's great if people are thinking that about how they can support those of us in the Church of England wanting to reform and renew it for biblical faith. We're facing things that are existential, really. So on a congregational model, you can, in some ways, just set up a new church if it all
Yeah,
goes bad. You can't really do that on an Anglican model of things. And so if it all goes pear-shaped for us, we could lose house, job, church all at once and not know what to do about it. So it is a sort of existential crisis for many, and that's deeply worrying. And so any encouragement to stand firm and more sympathy, empathy in such a situation will be really well received, I would have thought, even if it's only a postcard, an email, a pat on the shoulder if you see them in the streets, or a phone call to say, I've heard about all this stuff. I'm sorry you're having to deal with it. Please pray, please know that we're praying for you. That would be wonderful.
And I'm just thinking as well, we need to be, as we talked about before, sensitive to the context people are
Yes.
in. And I guess, many of us will have grown. I grew up in an Anglican church, so I decided a long time ago I wasn't an Anglican. Sorry, Lee.
You apostatized.
Yes, maybe. So I think it's very easy for someone in my position to say, well, of course you just leave and, start. And in fact, I have heard a well-known Anglican bishop say exactly that. Well, you just need to leave, and that's mission. That's the cost of mission. And I just think there needs to be a bit more sensitivity, doesn't there? That actually, as you say, it is existential. We're
Yeah.
talking about, livelihoods. We're talking about house. We're talking about pension. And these things, of course, there's a cost to following Christ and serving Christ. But I worry that we could be very easily too glib about that. And
Yes.
we mustn't be.
Believe me, all of us have thought about it. All of us have considered it. And it won't just be those practical, pragmatic, earthly things that are stopping us from doing it. There are also other reasons because, to be honest, a lot of us are very bloody minded and we don't want to give up to the liberals, who are cuckoos in the nest. We don't want to give up something that is precious about the Church of England Anglican. So, as I say, our doctrine is supposed to be the scriptures and good reformed Protestant doctrine. Why should we give up just because some liberals have captured some levers of power? We don't think that we should give up right away. So, but we've all thought about it because it's nauseating, exhausting. So, don't call us all to suddenly leave
No.
because that would be painful
Well, we're
and
trying
we've
not to do
considered
that.
it and are trying not to. And every church is different. It's a different situation for
Well,
everybody, and
also,
it's
I
a different
think, and this
process.
is just a general principle in ministry anyway, isn't it? That actually we've got to be careful about binding other people's consciences.
That's it.
I think different people will have a different level of conscience. For some people, that will be an easy thing and easy decisions to make. Other people, that's very different. And I think it's very easy to be judgmental about people who don't have the same conscience level. And that's
Yeah.
not a technical term, but you know what I mean. I think we've got to be
We
careful.
will all disagree on tactics within, we do already within different groups within conservative
Which
evangelicalism. We
presumably is a
disagree
great
on
satanic strategy, isn't
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
it?
great conspiracy. But we'll disagree on how to respond to it. And we need to be careful to make sure we're not writing off people who are almost exactly the same as us, but just disagreeing on this tiny thing. In terms of approach to kickback, pushback against this stuff. So we have to be careful not to judge and write each other off for those things. But also remember, I think, that our response to false teaching is on a spectrum. So we all know we need to fight valiantly against the world, the flesh, and the devil, and to be Christ's faithful soldiers and servants, because that's what we say at baptisms in the Church of England. So we know we need to do that. But the way we do that could be preaching against it, writing a sermon against it, joining a petition, withholding our parish share for a bit, just pausing it maybe, to full-blown leaving the Church of England for something else. There are a spectrum of responses, and different churches can make different responses at different times, and we need to be careful not to say everyone should do this right now. So I guess one challenging, if you want to challenge us, ask us, what are you doing to respond to it, rather than telling us we ought to do one particular thing? Yeah. Because we're all doing something.
That's really helpful, Lee. Thank you very much. Listen, we're out of time. Oh, go on. Yes, you've got 1 minute.
Okay, Paul writes 1 Timothy to tell Timothy, counter false teaching in Ephesus. That's why I'm telling you to stay there, counter it. And when he gets around to saying what he should do first, beginning of chapter 2, first of all, then, I urge you to pray. So people ask me all the time, what are you going to do about all of this false teaching? But very few people turn up to the prayer meetings to pray about it. So that should be our first of all response to any of this. So we take that as a challenge, but please also, FIC friends, brothers and sisters, pray for us.
We will happily accept that. Lee, it's been a great help. Thank you. I understand a lot more, and we will be praying on. It does seem like it's been a very long, drawn out process. There's still a way to go, it sounds. So we're praying. All hope is not lost. And we pray for you, especially, Lee, and for folk at the Church Society and the CEEC. I think that's what it's called. Yeah. And we'll pray that you'll continue to stand firm. So thanks for joining us, Lee. We do appreciate your time. And thank you for joining us. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, please do rate or review or leave a comment about how much you like Lee Gates' beard. And then that way people will discover us and listen in. Thanks very much, Lee, and see you again soon.
Thank you.